Hello, Marnie Chesterton from Crowd Science here, just gate-crashing the podcast you actually downloaded to mention mine. If you're the type of person who's ever wondered anything about the world around you, then we are the podcast for you. We take your questions on anything scientific and scour the globe for answers. That's Crowd Science, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. I'll get out of your ears now, as you were.
Hello and welcome to Discovery from the BBC World Service. I'm Philip Ball. Just how do bees do it? I'm talking about the natural marvel of geometrical precision engineering that is the honeycomb. Its cells have perfectly hexagonal shapes, the ideal design for filling up space with compartments that use the least amount of wax, and which therefore requires the bees to invest as little time and energy as possible in making them. That's exactly what Charles Darwin's evolution by natural selection would lead you to expect. The living world finds good solutions to problems, because those are the ones that best help organisms to survive and reproduce. But does Darwinian evolution really explain the honeycomb? Exactly 100 years ago, a little-known Scottish zoologist published a book that suggested this wasn't the whole story. After all, wrote Darcy Wentworth Thompson, professor of biology at Dundee University, this hexagonal pattern is just what we find in some non-living systems too. Float a layer of identical soap bubbles on water, and you'll see the same shapes. The bubbles join into a raft of hexagonal cells as they stick together. So, do we really need to appeal to Darwin's idea to explain the honeycomb? Or, Thompson asked, are the rules of physics enough? Might the surface tension that pulls the bubble layer into hexagons also pull soft wax into this geometric pattern? The honeycomb was just one of many examples of natural form, shape and pattern described in Thompson's masterpiece on growth and form, published in 1917. Here's what he said about shapes in nature.
Cell and tissue, shell and bone, leaf and flower are so many portions of matter, and it is in obedience to the laws of physics that their particles have been moved, moulded and conformed.
The laws of physics? Moulding a flower? That was some claim. Darcy Thompson's mission was to bring mathematics into biology, to show that the shapes and forms and growth processes we see in the living world aren't some arbitrary result of evolution's blind searching, but are dictated by mathematical rules. A flower, a honeycomb, a dragonfly's wing. It's not sheer chance that these look the way they do. On Growth and Form has astonished and inspired many scientists over the past 100 years, as well as artists and designers like Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth. It certainly had that effect on me when I first came across it. It opened my eyes to a kind of regularity, order and unity in nature that I'd never noticed before. On Growth and Form is a catalogue of wonders. Nothing like it had ever been written before, and we're still grappling with some of the questions it asked. It discusses the spiral form of snail shells and the interwoven spirals of seeds in the heads of sunflowers. Thompson made comparisons between the skeletons of dinosaurs and the arching network of struts in the Forth Bridge near his home city of Edinburgh. He talks about how the honeycomb is echoed in the hexagonal pattern of cracks that carves out geometric columns of basalt at Fingal's Cave on the Scottish island of Staffa. He explained how the crown-like shapes of splashes, frozen with the new technique of flash photography, resemble the forms of jellyfish and other sea creatures. He showed how one species of fish, drawn on a grid which was then stretched and deformed like a sheet of rubber, could be transformed into another species entirely. in a dazzling medley of mathematics and mechanics, anatomy and cell biology, physics and chemistry, Thomson offered a compelling argument for what he asserted to his students that, as he put it,
the fertile field of discovery lies for the most part on those borderlands where one science meets another.
But on growth and form was even more than this. Flitting casually between ancient Greek and Latin, German, Italian and French, it laid out its case in prose so elegant and gorgeous that the eminent biologist Peter Medawar was later inspired to call it, beyond comparison, the finest work of literature in all the annals of science that have been recorded in the English tongue. It's a work that exudes scholarship on every page, revealing D'Arcy Thomson as one of the last true polymaths. He felt that there was knowledge not just in the latest science, but in the works of Plato and Aristotle. And like Plato, he believed in general, overarching principles that might help us understand the world, principles embodied in maths and geometry, which could carry us beyond a minute cataloguing of particulars. Classics and natural history were D'Arcy's first loves, passions he inherited from his father, a professor of Greek in Ireland. Born in 1860, D'Arcy was raised in Edinburgh by his aunt, his mother having died a week after his birth. He went to Edinburgh University to study medicine, but it was really zoology and botany that drew him, and he transferred to Cambridge, then the only university to offer biology as a distinct subject. He supported himself there partly by teaching Greek. He was something of an academic loner, and he was disappointed when he failed to get a fellowship at Cambridge. Instead, he went back to Scotland, taking a post at the new University of Dundee, where he focused on marine biology. There, too, he was still an outsider. Biology was dominated by a rather crude form of Darwinism, which simply accepted that organisms had the forms they did because of adaptation. Meanwhile, zoology tended to stick to an old tradition of comparing one species or one bone of one species to another, and not to think too hard about how they got that way. But in D'Arcy Thomson's view, Darwinism doesn't operate with a completely free hand, and not all that we see is an adaptation by natural selection. Biological forms like the shapes of an amoeba or a cell, he said, can no more be regarded as selected for than can the spherical form of a water droplet. They are the way they are because of the physical forces that act on them. Take the bees. Charles Darwin saw the honeycomb as a marvellous example of the economy of evolution. He said,
"Beyond this stage of perfection in architecture, natural selection could not lead. For the comb of the hive bee, as far as we can see, is absolutely perfect in economising wax and labour."
"No, it isn't," Thomson said. "The walls of the comb cells don't just intersect like flat geometrical planes, and bees aren't skilled enough to make them that way." "The bee makes no economies," he objected, adding,
"that the beautiful regularity of the bee's architecture is due to some automatic play of the physical forces, and that it were fantastic to assume that the bee intentionally seeks for a method of economising wax is certain."
Is it really, though? Thomson admitted that the precise way in which physics shapes the honeycomb isn't clear. And actually, it still isn't clear today if physics has anything to do with it at all. We now know that bees do have faculties for measuring out the hexagonal angles of their cells, and for machining the precise thickness of the wax walls. Some researchers, though, still insist that much of the construction work is done by surface tension alone. They think that round, bubble-like cavities form in soft wax surrounding the bodies of the bees and warmed by their heat, and the wax then flows spontaneously into hexagons. We still don't really know how much is physics and how much is biology. If we can't decide that even for the rather simple case of honeycombs and hexagons, how much harder it is to explain many of the complex forms we find in the rest of the living world. So On Growth and Form had set itself a tough challenge. Matthew Jarron is curator of museum services at the University of Dundee, and there he looks after the Darcy Thompson Museum, which houses some of the vast collection of bones, specimens and objects that Thompson amassed.
I think what he was really interested in was looking at the way that organisms grow and why different shapes recur in nature, so things like hexagonal symmetry in the honeycomb, but many other sort of spiral forms and other things as well. Why do these same shapes keep occurring? And he really wanted to encourage, in a sense, a whole new field of operation, in that he was really the first to take the ideas of mathematics and physical forces and apply those to biology. And that was a really controversial idea at the time. Very few people really accepted that that could be done. And he really hoped that this would lead to a whole new field of inquiry.
So what were biologists doing at this time? How were they going about their business?
It's actually a really interesting period in biology because there are lots of different ideas all being hotly debated at the time. Darwinian ideas of evolution had become very largely established by that point, to the extent that a lot of people really thought that could explain everything through adaptation. And Darcy felt that wasn't the case, that there were things that couldn't answer and there must be more to discover there. At the same time, you get opposing view of vitalism, this idea that comes from the old religious view that because God created all life, therefore you couldn't explain the secrets of life through man-made laws like physics and mathematics. And Thompson, in a sense, was quite intrigued by that idea. He quite liked the idea that there were kind of things that couldn't be explained, but ultimately, as far as he was concerned, physical science was the only thing you needed in order to explain how things grew. And Darcy said, well, if evolution by natural selection is correct, then all these things have the same evolutionary pressures on them, so they should all evolve into the same form, but clearly they don't. So evolution can't explain that, but looking at mathematics and looking at the physical forces shaping those organisms can.
And it seems that he was doing that by drawing analogies between some of those forms that we see in the living world and some that we see in the non-living world.
Absolutely, and this is another thing that was being hotly discussed in biology at the time. Could you look at inorganic forms like crystals, cracks in rocks, soap bubbles, and compare them to organic forms like flowers, sea urchins, dragonfly wings? And there was a lot of idea at the time that one evolved from the other, that we could look at organic forms, and ultimately those actually had evolved from inorganic forms. And a lot of experiments were going on to try to, in a sense, create life from inorganic matter, from crystals and so on. None of these, of course, came to anything. But what Darcy was really interested in was looking at those similarities of form and saying, well, actually, why is it that these things recur again and again? And he was looking at the physical forces and saying, well, these same forces are operating on both organic and inorganic matter, and therefore the same shapes will occur.
In a sense, he was laying down a gauntlet to the Darwinism of its time. How did biologists take that?
Well, it was received very well in terms of the language that he used, in terms of the wonderful breadth of his knowledge and examples. It was very highly praised in that sense. But I think a lot of biologists simply couldn't see how they could apply what Darcy was saying to their own work and didn't really see the point of including mathematics or other theoretical ideas in what, as far as they were concerned, was a very practical science. And the way that On Growth and Form is structured is that it starts off looking at very simple organisms and then gradually moves to larger, more complex organisms. And by the time that he gets to entire things like fish, for example, he says, well, I can't explain the form of a fish just through mathematics, but what we can do is look at two different fish and show how, by a very simple mathematical transformation, we can show how one might have evolved into the other. And so there were one or two sort of lone followers who tried to continue that work, but really they were very much in the minority, and the vast majority of biologists were increasingly focused on evolution. And of course, at just the time that On Growth and Form came out, we have the whole development of genetics and all of that coming through, which Darcy really doesn't deal with at all in On Growth and Form. It wasn't that he wasn't interested or it wasn't something that he thought was right. He just felt that it simply wasn't relevant for his argument. And so really for most of his lifetime, it remained very much on the fringes of biology. And it really wasn't till after he died that a few sort of key people like Alan Turing, for example, started to take it forward. And then more and more people started to get interested. And then finally, around the 1970s, we get this whole explosion of computers, and that really allowed his ideas to be tested in a way that they couldn't be before. And that then started a whole new era, really, of mathematical biology.
And it wasn't just scientists who were reading his book.
Absolutely, and I think really long before it came into the mainstream of biology, it was being picked up by artists and architects and designers. Sculptors, for example, like Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth, Noam Gabo, who were really interested in looking at the way that organisms form and trying to replicate that through their wonderful biomorphic sculptures. But also, again, architects, engineers, philosophers, very few of them probably actually read the whole thing cover to cover. Mostly they were just looking at the illustrations, but there are so many wonderful illustrations. And certainly it's one of the great differences between that and The Origin of Species, which has no diagrams at all. So actually what's wonderful about On Growth and Form is that it is very much a visual manifesto of Darcy's ideas as much as the text.
Now, I confess that I find Darcy Thompson something of an enigma in that I still struggle to see, if you like, where he came from. How did he get to this extraordinary synthesis of mathematics and biology and physics and even chemistry from being a, in some ways, what seemed like a humble marine biologist at a new university in Scotland? What was it, you think, about the man himself that led him to these ideas?
I think there are a number of things. One really important one is his great love of the classics. And we know that his father was a classics lecturer and then became a professor of Greek. And he very much instilled in young Darcy a great love of particularly Aristotle. Aristotle, of course, Darcy saw as really the first great biologist. And so he comes from that background of really being one of the last great polymaths, of course, at the very time that science is becoming more and more specialist.
So at least some of Darcy Thompson's ideas were before their time, in that we didn't have the tools, literally the computational tools in some cases, to properly explore them.
Absolutely. And I think that there's no doubt that, you know, had computers existed in Darcy's era, all that might have happened a lot earlier. But also, I think sort of apparently opposing camps of evolutionary biologists and developmental biologists who were more sort of in Darcy's favour, for a long time, those were seen as completely oppositional. And it was only really in the 70s and 80s that they started to come back together. And we now have this idea of evo-devo, or evolutionary developmental biology, where the two things have actually come together. And people, I think, increasingly have recognised that, yes, we need Darwin's theories to explain why things will evolve from one form to another, but we need Darcy's theories to explain what form things will evolve into.
Maybe the pendulum has now swung towards Darcy Thompson's way of thinking, but On Growth and Form itself is a curious beast. Some of the book looks today like the last stand of a Victorian preference for elegance and beauty before biology came to be dominated in the 20th century by the notion that everything is in the genes, that shape, form and pattern are merely the literal-minded readout of a detailed genetic program. Yet, as Matthew says, we can regard those two points of view as being in balance, not in competition. There need be no conflict between Darwinian evolution and Darcy Thompson's trust in geometry and mechanics. Instead, what On Growth and Form offers 100 years on is a new way of looking at the world, a way that notices similarities and analogies of shape and form, and which shows that beauty can arise from simple growth processes and laws. Veronica Greenison of the John Innes Centre in Norwich studies one of the most familiar and also diverse of those forms, the growth of plants and the shapes of their cells. Once, those questions would have been solely the territory of botanists. But Veronica agrees with Darcy Thompson that you need physics too to understand how plants grow.
I started out as a physicist. In fact, the reason I studied physics, although I was always very fascinated with biology, is because as a girl in school, I always thought that biology, you couldn't really ask the question why or how. It was more about, well, this is how things are. And I was wandering around the physics library, and I studied in Brazil. There was this very old book crumbling down full of dust, and it was On Growth and Form. And it's one of those books that it's like a poetry book. You just open it and you can start reading wherever, and it already grasps your attention. And I found, wow, this is so interesting. And it was actually someone who dared to bring mathematics together with biology. And then I realized there is all this potential of crossing disciplines. And one can ask these questions. That was the spark of the motivation, which, you know, years afterwards, I'm a biologist doing systems biology. And in this growing area, I meet many young scientists and also senior scientists that they share this experience of how important this book has been for them. Although he writes his book in a very intellectual manner, he's a bit of a child. He's looking at things and just being very marveled and fascinated, as we are, I think, when we look at a flower and see those spirals. But the reason he's pointing this out is because he's asking a question, which is, how is something as simple as a flower able to generate that positioning, those spacing of those seeds? And nowadays, we have understanding of the mechanisms, because that's what he was calling for. And the mechanism by itself can be encapsulated in a very simple form, which is that in the growth of this flower, those seeds, when they're forming, they try to avoid each other. But they're avoiding each other while the domain, so the surface of that flower, is growing. And in that way, these spacing of the seeds, they result. So these are hypotheses which we can also test on computers. We can actually comprehend how it's working. And this is something that I'm investigating in my lab and many colleagues. What we don't understand very well now is, why do things avoid each other? How do they know that something else is close by? So how does biology, cells, how do they communicate things to one another to be able to generate organization?
Is it the case then that this geometric spiral arrangement that we see is something that emerges just from the way the parts of the system, in this case, the little buds of the growing seeds, the way they interact?
Exactly. So on one level, when you understand it like that, it seems simple. One just needs to have interaction and growth. So what we start seeing is that these interactions, they are mapped to other things in biology that we more recently have a hold on and an understanding, which is that cells, they polarize, they position little pumps on their membranes, and these pumps, they secrete hormones. It's like a signal. So they're starting to communicate, like making a long-distance telephone. One is talking to the other, which is talking to the next, and so forth. And in such a way, they're able to know where each bud is located, and they are able to communicate where new regions should be formed. Now, we're studying this in the lab and trying to then understand how that level of description can be mapped on again to the level of description of Darcy Thompson. So what Darcy Thompson was saying, he was saying back then, just because we see something which is complex doesn't mean that what's orchestrating that is complex. It could be simple elements, but their interaction and the way that they interfere with one another results in something very complex. And this is a warning for biologists then, and it's a warning for biologists now, which is to say, just because we can see each time more complexity, more structure, more fine details, it doesn't mean that the laws governing that are as numerous as the forms which we see. They could be more simple, but we have to understand how they interact to create this.
It sounds then as though to really understand the problem, we need to know about all of those different levels. It's one thing to know that these molecules, these plant hormones, in some way affect the growth of the plant. But that's never going to tell you by itself how it gives rise to the particular form that we see.
Exactly. That's the key message of this book. Although what we're looking at is matter, it's an organism, it has physical rules operating, what Darcy Thompson says, don't try to find the answer in stuff. It's not going to be the protein or the gene. He doesn't say gene, but he hints on it. He says it's about the interaction between the stuff. And if we understand these principles, they might be operating on even very diverse organisms, but the principles are the same. And it reverberates very strongly nowadays because we're in a luxurious position. We have a lot of, we have computers, data storage, amazing microscopes. So now we can really look into and zoom into details. But this is also, and he warned for this, if we look at each time more fine-grained details and see more and more complexity and structure, it might give the impression that we will have to find more genes which are causing those complex formations. But it might actually deviate us from understanding what the mechanism is. And this is something which nowadays people are realizing. And we're taking a step back. So it's wonderful to have the data. It's wonderful to have these techniques. But how do they interact? It's a new movement in science. And we call that systems biology. This is the new word for it. But it's what D'Arcy Thompson had 100 years ago.
So you think that in some ways we can regard On Growth and Form as the first book on systems biology?
Oh, definitely. My personal opinion is that we as humans, we're a bit limited to see something in its entirety the whole time. We have to always look at it from an angle. So it's very important to have these different angles and not to fight between them, but to be able to understand when can we shift from, you know, from perspective A to perspective B, and how can we combine them. So I think his book becomes, with a new vigor, very important.
It seems to me that this aspect is reflected in what you do, the fact that you work on plants and how they grow.
Yes.
And I understand you also work with robots that interact with one another.
Yes. And, I hope that D'Arcy, if he were alive, he would also have a lot of fun with this, because the idea is, if we really understand the principles, could we even embed them in a system which is artificial? But it has also common traits. These little robots, they communicate locally, like cells, and they have a lot of noise and imperfection. Each one is a bit different than the others. Yet the process should be robust enough that all these robots together are still able to form shapes and patterns.
Can you get the robots to form sunflower heads yet?
Actually, we can.
From flowers to robots and back again. There's something biblical about the way you can find almost any message you please in On Growth and Form. Is it the first great work of systems biology, or of mathematical biology, or complexity science? In the end, it's in a category of its own. A work not so much of anticipation as of imagination and inspiration. It helps us to look at the world afresh and find wonder in what seemed familiar and mundane. In an age of increasing specialisation, it's almost a manifesto for taking the broad view.